Welcome to the Optimum Nutrition Podcast, brought to you by the Institute for Optimum Nutrition. ION is one of Europe's longest established nutritional therapy training providers. Our aim is to support people in making a positive impact on their lives with food. I'm Alice Ball, Communications Officer at ION. Each week, I'm going to be interviewing a guest from the world of nutrition. We'll be delving into their health journey and touching on some common health conditions, with the aim of inspiring you to be your most optimally healthy and happiest self. I'm really pleased to be joined by Nicola Moore for this very first episode. Nicola is a nutritional therapist who worked as head of clinics at the Institute for over 10 years. Our discussion today is really focused on how we can cut through the conflicting messages around what and how we should eat and build healthy and positive relationships with food. If you enjoy the episode and want to find out more about nutritional therapy, including ION's courses, clinic, and magazine, then head to our website, ion.ac.uk. But for now, here's Nicola Moore on the Optimum Nutrition Podcast. Nicola Moore, welcome to the Optimum Nutrition Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here.
We're happy to have you on. I wanted to start by asking you to name your top three kitchen essentials for me. So these are three ingredients that you always have in your fridge, always have in your kitchen cupboards, and just give you that little peace of mind.
Oh gosh, and only three.
So if you're on a desert island, which three ingredients are you going to be taking?
I think that there would be things that would help other things to taste good. So some sort of fat. So maybe that would be olive oil, would be something that I'd always have. A seasoning, so maybe some salt. And let's say another, gosh, there's lots of things that I always have. But let's say some garlic, because it's got so many health benefits. And I think the combination of olive oil and garlic is really, really nice. And a little bit of salt for seasoning. Then I would be able to turn a lot of things that I found on that desert island into something tasty.
They're three good ingredients. I think I'd take the same three, actually.
Yeah, good.
So I want to talk about building positive relationships with food in this episode. So you're a registered nutritional therapist. Do you want to explain a little bit about what you do for a living?
Yes. So I studied at ION in the year 2000 is when it all fell into place for me. Up until that point, I had been working in banking in a very soulless job. I would say I was surviving in a world that didn't suit me. And I'd also been travelling. And so my sole purpose in life until that point, I think, really had been about earning money so that I could save, so that I could leave and go travelling and then come back and do the same sort of thing again. And so for my role now as a nutritional therapist, I worked for many years at ION in the academic team, as well as working with clients. But now I predominantly am working one-to-one with clients, supporting them with their nutrition. And I work mostly with women who are feeling really low in energy, that they've got brain fog, they're tired, their hormones are feeling a bit all over the place, that they maybe feel bloated. But also in conjunction with that, you know, they don't know what to eat and they're very nervous about food and they're reading a lot of information about what they should eat, what they shouldn't eat. And they're very confused and almost berating themselves and living in a world where they've got, you know, the words that's bad for me or that's naughty and this is a good day. And when you explore it, they're not really enjoying the good day food and they're being propelled towards what they consider to be bad. So I'm sort of working on the physiological level, which is what I really enjoy, looking at how nutrition affects cellular chemistry and hormones and inflammation and gut and all of that stuff. But I'm also just as passionate about helping people to feel safe and free and supported with their dietary choices. So that's what I'm doing a lot of, working, you know, in the group setting and working one-to-one.
And so has it taken you a long time to yourself build a healthy relationship with food? So if we go back to when you were like a teen, for example, did you always make the connection between what you were eating and how you were feeling?
No. So when I was a teenager and as a youngster, I think my mum would describe me as a fussy eater. There would have been meals that I would have liked, but I don't really remember having a passion for food or cooking or anything like that. And then as I became a teenager, in younger years, I'd say I suffered from a degree of anxiety as a youngster. And then as a teenager, I became more, I think unwell is too strong a word, but I was suffering with a lot of digestive problems, pain, abdominal pain. And then when my period started, that really changed a lot of things for me. I was in incredible pain with my periods and put on the contraceptive pill as a teenager because I kept missing school because I would be just collapsed in pain and often vomiting with the pain. But there was never any talk about food, and you don't know what you don't know. So it didn't really occur to me. And all through that time, I just had food but didn't really enjoy it that much, I suppose. I don't even know. I couldn't even tell you. I don't remember. Really remember that my mum was very, very health conscious in the 1980s or the late 70s, early 80s, and me feeling embarrassed that we were having wholemeal bread when everyone else was having white bread. And I was very embarrassed that my packed lunches looked different to other people, and I was never allowed crisps and things. And I remember there being a bit of a push and pull with my mum about that. And then when I became old enough to really make more of my own food choices, really going to town with chocolate bars and all of that kind of thing. And I think even as a 20-something, I didn't really cook that much when I moved out of home. I was working in the city. I was with my friends. We were doing a lot of eating out, a lot of drinking, having a good time. And if I did cook, it would be things that you'd cook on top of the stove. You know, to open the oven and cook in the oven was not something that I would think of doing. And when I went traveling, I think that that's when I first started really experiencing the delights and pleasure of food. And I remember just before going away, before going to Asia or something, reading an article that was talking about different compounds in foods and how they were good for health. And I remember that lighting a bit of a spark for me. So eventually, when I came back from traveling and was really lost and thinking, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? You know, sitting in meetings with people where and sitting on the train going to work and just feeling dead inside. I think that at that point, I'd started really becoming interested in the beneficial compounds in food, more from a sort of chemistry point of view. And then my health really took a nosedive. So the digestion and the pains became really unmanageable. Yeah. But I eventually went to see a nutritional therapist, and it was seeing her that really, really opened my eyes to a new way that I could eat. And it just lit such a spark in me. It really did.
It's interesting you went to go and see a nutritional therapist. Who was it who recommended you do that?
I was sat on the train and I saw someone sitting opposite me reading Patrick Holford's Optimum Nutrition Bible. Now, I remember looking at that and it had quite a memorable cover and thinking, oh, that looks like a good book. And then I happened to see the book in a bookshop not long afterwards, so I bought it. And in the back of that book, it spoke about the Institute for Optimum Nutrition and Studying. So at that point, I thought, oh, that's good. I'll do that weekend course. And I remember phoning up ION, because this is pre-internet. So I phoned up ION, and then hearing from them, I'd have to do a year of science first and then, you know, 3 years of studying. I had a bit of a wobble, but I thought, no, I'm going to do it. But I think if I'm going to do it, I'm going to work with someone. I'm pretty sure it probably went that way round. And then there was a local health food shop where a nutritional therapist was working.
And then that sort of confirmed to you that now that I can take control of my own health, you wanted to help other people with theirs?
More selfish than that, I wanted a job that I enjoyed. So, you know, it wasn't so much about let me change the world, if I'm really honest. It was coming from a place for me of total desperation. I was feeling really unwell and I absolutely hated my job. I absolutely hated it. And the thought of this being the rest of my life, this being it, was awful to me. So to then find something that really engaged me for the first time, a subject that really lit me up, I thought, I've just got to go for this. I've just got to do it. And I used to skip to my lectures, genuinely. I mean, I just was so happy. And then what was also really nice was I'd got into of course, eating healthily, but this is before all of the lovely stuff that's happened in the last 10, 15 years. So I was considered a social leper. You know, I was then going into work with, you know, salads that had broccoli in them. Now, when I was doing that, you know, the looks I would get from colleagues were that I was absolutely mad, and I would be having seeds and stuff. This was bizarre to people. It wouldn't be bizarre now, would it? You know, it's funny how it's all changed. And when I started studying, to be in a room full of people that were also munching on seeds, well, I can't tell you. I felt like, oh, I'm with people who are like me now. This is great. So it was really good fun.
So it was 4 years. And were you working still part-time during that time as well?
Full-time.
So you must have just been itching to complete your qualification and get out into practice.
Yes. So I've always been totally self-sufficient. So everything that I've done, I've paid for myself, I've worked throughout. So I had to carry on working while I was studying. I had to fund the studying, number one. I had to pay my bills. So when I first graduated, what I did was I couldn't tell anyone at work that I was studying, because it was a sort of environment where you wouldn't get a pay rise, or you wouldn't maybe get your bonus or whatever. Well, that was certainly how I felt, especially if you imagine as a female in a very male dominated, again, you know, it's still not equal, but it was even less equal at that point. So when I first left ION, having graduated, I carried on with my full-time job, and I would work two evenings a week down in a clinic room that I hired with a friend of mine who I'd studied with down at London Bridge. So I would finish my day's work and then go and do evening clinics a London Bridge, and then from there it grew and grew.
Was it word of mouth and people would refer clients to you, and then you were able to?
So it was quite good to begin with. I had a really good friend who was working as a physiotherapist at the London Bridge Hospital, so that was wonderful. She was referring people to me. I also had a friend who was a personal trainer, and she was referring people to me. I firmly believe that the best way to build a business like this is through the results that you have and getting referrals. And so before long, they were referring people to me. The clients that I saw were referring their friends and so on. And so it grew and grew from there.
I guess for you then, what is a positive relationship with food?
Well, for me, number one, it's about freedom, and it's about having choice. It's about not having to be overly thinking or constantly consumed with thoughts about food. I wouldn't say it's not turning to food for comfort, because I feel like food can offer you a wonderful comfort, and so can drink. It's knowing what to pick that's the important thing there. But that is what I would see. And I think where this has come from for me is that from my very first days working with clients, I was seeing people who were on restrictive diets. So when I was first studying, there was a book called The Anti-Candida Diet that was very, very popular. And anyone that was sort of into a holistic approach to nutrition seemed to have an understanding of candida. There was a lot of fear that every illness or condition was due to this thing called candida, which is a yeast that is part of a actually normal microbiome. So this book encouraged people, based on a N equals one study of one lady doing something to help her chronic fatigue, which was all based around candida and her feeling better from that. We then have a book come out, which is one of my bugbears with nutrition in general. So we had a book come out on a sort of N equals one study that was telling people to follow the exact same path. And that path included massively restricting loads of different foods. What I identified within weeks of working with clients is that people were coming in on an anti-candida diet or some kind of restrictive diet because they genuinely weren't feeling well. But to me, it didn't make sense that taking out all of these foods that are actually often really, really good for you, like mushrooms or like root vegetables or fruit, taking these things out, I didn't understand how that could possibly be helpful. And I couldn't find research. Now, in those days, you had to go to the British Library and things like that. And then you were reliant on these books. But if you looked at the books, you know, looking for the research papers that they were citing in the books was challenging. I began working with clients quite quickly to encourage them to find a different way to feel better, which was actually to enable a really healthy, balanced diet. It's not rocket science. It, you know, how do you eat? How do you build a meal? What components do you need? How do you look on that food to feel encouraged and healthy? And how can you eat in a way where you feel satisfied rather than eating a load of bland food that's restrictive, that means that you never feel quite satisfied? You're looking for symptoms every time you eat, and so therefore you might be getting symptoms because of the connection we know with the neurological pathways as well. So I suppose I'd get on my soapbox about it. And when I got the opportunity to start lecturing, when I was working at the Institute for Optimal Nutrition, you know, the first lecture, I think it was, that I was able to take on was a meal planning lecture to the first years. And I thought, this is my opportunity now to actually try and start talking above this noise and presenting a different argument, and to be looking at inclusion rather than exclusion.
Do you think that's the biggest mistake that everybody makes? And do you see it with clients a lot? They come to you and they have a health issue, or they're trying to lose weight, and they always are cutting out foods rather than thinking, how can I diversify my diet?
I think that's one of the really big problems. And we have this dieting culture, and we have a culture of things being bad, or even fats now. You know, the tide is changing on that, but we've been brought up, especially the women that I'm working with who are sort of, you know, late 40s, 50s, their formative years have been very much based on the margarine culture. It's very difficult during formative years, if you've picked up messages about diet, it's very difficult to untangle that, you know, even within itself. So as a result, what I'm seeing is people are restricting in another number of ways. So you've got the people that have got lots of digestive problems. They have a hunch of food doesn't agree with them, so they take that food out. They might feel better. It actually might be really useful to take that food out, you know. But then actually the problems come back again, or they don't fully get resolved. So then they start thinking, could it be this food? So they take another food out, and so on and so on and so on. So that's one thing that I see. And the people are coming to me because they're still not feeling any better. I think that's the major thing. And then you've got people who are not allowing themselves to eat in a particular way, especially maybe during the day, because they're trying to be healthy. They're trying to have maybe a low fat diet or a low carb diet, or whatever it is that they're trying to do, with all good intentions, by the way, you know, to be healthy. Yeah. But as a result of that, maybe they're not actually that satisfied from the meal, and they're often then by the afternoon starving, then making food choices that for them create a sense of shame and guilt. That's what I mean about being free. They're not free in their food choices. They're restricting in other ways. They're maybe restricting in the sense of pleasure, or they're restricting in the way of a food group, or they're restricting in the way of an ingredient. You know, there's different ways in which you can restrict.
Yeah, I suppose the message here is that healthy doesn't have to mean restrictive or boring. And
yeah,
it's difficult because people are bombarded with so much information and so many conflicting messages about what and how they should eat. So keto, for example, quite a buzzword, and obviously there can be benefits to that. And then veganism. Do people come to you quite often with a set diet in mind, thinking that that is the way they should be eating because that's what they're told?
They can do. I mean, I think from the way I try and position myself, hopefully people, by the time they get in touch with me, they're coming because actually they're seeing that I might offer a different solution that's maybe much more personalised and really looking at them as a human being. And, you know, what do we actually do with you based on your life and your likes and dislikes and stuff? But yes, there are all of these different ways of eating. And I think that there are so many things that come into food choices that are really relevant, whether it's ethical, religious, moral reasons, whatever, you know, that's really, really valid. So it's not really ever about none of these approaches are any good at all. It's more about what's the best thing for you. So if we look at keto, for example, and I do find, depending on what sex you are as well, it plays a big role, but the ketogenic diet is often misunderstood and not eaten as it's really been intended or devised, but it does require large amounts of fats in the diet. Now, genetically, some of us actually aren't set up that well to manage things like saturated fat. So a keto diet, ketogenic diet may be recommended because of, say, for example, you've been reading about Alzheimer's prevention and this seems like a sensible strategy, for example. But then if you were to look at the genetics for that one person, perhaps actually the saturated fats aren't as good for them as the polyunsaturated fats. And so they are better with more of the olive oils and stuff rather than all of the butters and coconut oil. And then from a vegan perspective, some people genetically, for example, they're not set up that well to convert things like beta-carotene to vitamin A. So beta-carotene is our vegetable source of vitamin A. You're not having meat, and vitamin A is so crucial for immune system, for so many different biochemical processes, but they might not be able to access it as well as they think. So there's so much individuality involved in it.
So then for somebody who maybe doesn't have access or the means to seek out help from a nutritional therapist, how would they even go about cutting through information about what they should eat? How would you recommend that they say, okay, that's information I can trust, or perhaps I shouldn't go down that route?
I think probably a very sensible strategy based on what we know from, you know, really clear evidence at the moment is, as a rule of thumb, something like a Mediterranean diet is a really good approach to eating. And maybe even beyond a Mediterranean diet, more saying looking at traditional cultural diets from culturally your background and so on. So the Mediterranean diet in its fullest true sense, and you probably have to go back to the Mediterranean diet. It's not the current Mediterranean diet because, you know, that everything is changing, but it's looking at, you know, having good quality proteins from things like meat, fish, eggs, but also vast amounts of vegetables, pulses and legumes and things like that. Lots of good oils from olive oil, but also from animal-based products. If you eat meat and fish and eggs, if you eat those things, you know, if they are local produce and they've been raised in a non sort of mass consumer way, we know that the quality of the fats is often better. So it's the right sorts of fats going in from that point of view. Seasonal eating and less amounts of the sugary processed foods. So not having them, but understanding there's a time and a place for them. And maybe having something small as a dessert, for example, and eating at meal times rather than constantly grazing and constantly having access to food. And between meals, doing something slightly physical, not just sitting. So the Mediterranean diet in its fullest sense goes beyond just what you have at the table. It goes into how you eat, the social aspect with it as well, you know, the movement that goes with it. That is a really good approach to eating, I think. But what you need to do is take somebody where they are now. You need to understand where somebody is at this moment in time. And I've found that it doesn't work to just say we were meeting for the first time today and you were eating a particular way and you had some health concerns. It wouldn't serve you at all for me to just say, this is a Mediterranean diet and this is the way you should eat, off you go. You know, you have to meet someone where they are at the moment, and you're looking over time with coaching, with support, with a bit of, I'd call it, nutritional counselling, looking at that person's relationship with food to educate and make some practical changes with what they're doing at the moment, that then as a staged process, you build on and build on and build on over time.
I suppose it's this idea that building a positive relationship with food takes time. It's not going to happen overnight, and it's a gradual change. So would you say that's the same with if someone is looking to make changes to their diet, rather than, as you said, thinking I've got to drastically overhaul and eat the Mediterranean diet? It would be introducing things step by step.
I think so for the majority of people. I mean, it depends on the personality type that you're working with as well, So there are some personality types who are very, look, I'm all or nothing. And that can be difficult because when they're on it and it's all great. But the thing I would then be working on then is how do I manipulate their neuroplasticity, so their resilience to stress, their highways in which we are set up to respond to stress and stuff. How can I be helping them nutritionally to manage that and look at their approach to eating while they're on it, so that the next time something happens with, you know, they break up with their partner or a big stressful event happens at work or their mum becomes ill again, that the old patterns of behaviour don't immediately come back, because that's what can happen with an all or nothing personality. But for the majority of people, it is about that slow and steady, reassuring someone. And really, you know, I often find even starting by looking at how someone's starting their day. Mm-hmm. If you can help somebody to understand the right way for them to eat in the first half of the day, then the positive consequences for the rest of the day and the next day and so on, into energy, food choices, metabolism, are profound.
And what sort of things might you recommend someone to eat for breakfast, for example?
Well, first of all, I'd even be saying to somebody, how hungry are you? So before I even look at what someone would eat, I've got a podcast called Healthily, and I did an episode looking just at this stuff. So before really even looking at what someone's going to eat, I would want to know, how do you feel? What's your appetite like? How hungry are you? So you're getting a bit of that information first. And sometimes people haven't engaged with that. So even asking that question is really good. So first of all, you'd be looking at, you know, how hungry are you first thing, for example. And then from there, we'd be looking at what's the right timing for you to eat based on all the jobs you've got to do in the morning, or the thing, you know, it has to be realistic. And then we would be looking really at, let's make sure this is a complete meal. Where is the protein? Where is the fiber? Where's the natural fat coming in? So that you're eating something that's going to sustain you and keep you going through the morning. Because often in the morning, people are either not that hungry, they're eating more like in a robotic sense. It's breakfast time, so I eat breakfast, so I have some cereal or a piece of toast or something. I'm not really engaging with it. I'm eating it on the go, or I'm not, you know. And it might be quite high in carbohydrates, say, versus some of the other food groups. And so then, of course, it's reasonable that you would then start feeling peckish quite soon after. Or by the time it comes to lunch, you are so hungry that you're just going for anything. Of course, that would make sense. So if you get the timing right and you get the balance right for that individual, it can be really transformative just with that one meal.
I think that's really interesting, because even things like intermittent fasting, and I think there's a bit of a buzzword at the moment about intuitive fasting, and it's got quite a bad rap really, but it's interesting that it's listening to your body. And perhaps if you are someone who doesn't get hungry until later in the morning, then it's not such a bad thing that that's how you eat.
I think that it's so individual. And I think the other thing to say is a lot of people don't actually, because if you take me, for example, as a youngster, I remember having tummy aches. I definitely remember being hungry. I remember being overly full and feeling quite uncomfortable. But, you know, there was never really any conversation or teaching for me about really engaging with food in that sort of way. So you're not just going to suddenly, for a lot of people, we're not just going to suddenly go, I know if I'm hungry or full even. So even doing that bit of work, or just becoming alive to the sensations of the body, is really useful in itself. So that's where intuitive eating can be quite helpful. But for some people, intuitive eating can be an absolute disaster. So if somebody has had issues with binge eating and emotional eating, and then all of a sudden they're being told, you can be free to eat whenever you want. For somebody that might work okay, but for a lot of people it's really, really confusing and totally overwhelming and not helpful at all. So some people actually do need more prescriptive approaches to how they eat, as a way of trying to help them, firstly, with their relationship with food, but also their physiology. So there isn't a perfect solution. And I think this is the reason why there is so much confusion, because there isn't a perfect solution. And it's trial and error. I'm normally saying to clients, I'm using the word experiment all the time. So every day in clinic, I'm saying, let's experiment with, because I don't know if it's going to work, but we give it a go and feedback and see how it goes. But it's just about inching forward.
Yeah, it almost feels like no one can get on the same page with how we should be eating. Because I noticed as well, you said sugar, for example, or processed food, there's a place for it, but perhaps less of a place for it. And something I've noticed with social media is that there's a lot of influencers who come from a good place in that they, like yourself, want to encourage people to have good relationships with food. But it's more of a foods created equally. And I wondered what your thoughts were on this idea of all food is equal.
I would rather come back to, I think a more useful position is that actually we all have a responsibility to be healthy. So it's a bit like exercising. We all know we should do some exercise. Now, that doesn't have to be going to the gym. It can just be going out for a walk. It doesn't have to be what you think it is, does it? But I would say the same does apply to food and lifestyle. So if people's ultimate aim is to be happy and healthy, that's me. I want to be happy and I want to be healthy. I know, therefore, that my health isn't a birthright. So I do have a responsibility to understand about healthy eating, whatever that looks like for me, and to work hard to ensure that I'm eating what we know to be a healthy diet. So therefore, it doesn't stand that I can eat a whole bag of Haribo sweets every single day because all food is created equal, because that for me doesn't match with what we know about health. And the other thing is that if I was eating a bag of Haribos every day, well, number one, it would rot my teeth. Secondly, it would encourage a sweet tooth. It would perpetuate cravings for other foods. It would disrupt my gut. And we know that, I mean, it's so interesting, the gut microbiome are driving our appetites and our food choices to a large extent. So, you know, what you see is people's taste buds change, their desire for sweetness changes, their desire for certain foods changes as you start building in more variety. So that's where I stand on it. I'm not saying you should never have Haribos, but I'm just saying there's a time and a place for them, and we all have a collective responsibility, I suppose, to our own health and the health of our families.
And you talk about the gut there, which is something I wanted to bring into it. Now, this is something you're really big on, isn't it? Eating in a way that nourishes the gut. So can you explain a little bit about the gut microbiome and what it does and why we should be focusing on it?
Yeah, so the microbiomes, well, we have microbiomes everywhere. So, and the more we learn, the more overwhelming it becomes. And so I'm certainly no big expert on this, in that I just find the more I learn, the more I realise what I don't know, to be perfectly honest with you. But if we're looking at the gut, that's relating to the tube from our mouth through to our bottom. We are hollow, you know, like the gut, we are hollow, which is why so much of our immune system is located in our gut, because it's an entry point for things coming in. And the oral and the esophageal and the stomach and the small intestine and the large intestine all have microbiomes. And these are basically colonies of bacteria, yeasts, parasites, the metabolites they produce, the little short-chain fatty acids that they make, the gases they produce, the little chemicals that are similar to serotonin and dopamine that are involved in our brain chemistry. All of these things, it's an amazing thing. It's an ecological system. And the microbiomes, we understand, you know, that you can have some, what we would refer to as dysbiosis, a bit of imbalance that can occur maybe in the mouth or further down in the gut, that can influence our digestive health and maybe our immune health potentially, depending on who we are and what's going on for us, and even how we manage our hormones and our brain chemistry. And what we do know is that having lots of different species and having diversity is how it's referred to, it seems to be a positive thing. And the way that you help the diversity is that you feed all of the different bacteria's lots of different foods in order that it allows for a balanced ecology to thrive and develop. So that's very sort of simplistically put, which is why some of the restrictive diets I have an issue with, because I don't see them being hugely beneficial for that. And the other thing to say is that, you know, there's really good research looking at different bacterial species and colonies of microbiomes and how that really does interact with our hunger and fullness mechanisms and our cravings and things like our serotonin levels and all of that sort of thing. So the gut plays into food in a way that you wouldn't necessarily think. So you might think, oh, the microbiome's helpful for digestion and I know I need to take, for example, probiotics to help with my IBS as a sort of example. But it goes so way beyond that.
And so that, in a way, might help people as a starting point for how they should be eating, is to think, is this food going to positively or negatively affect my gut health?
So the foods that I'd say are really nice for your gut, as a general rule, are anything from the plant kingdom. So that means, you know, vegetables, salad items, but also nuts and seeds and lentils and pulses and things. And some people get bloating with these things. So it's, you know, it's about understanding how each of these foods work for you. And if you are bloating, why? You know, that'd be my question. But then there are foods that we know that aren't so helpful for the ecology of the gut. So sugar in large quantities doesn't seem to be helpful. Certainly sweeteners are not helpful. So the researchers report deranged microbiomes under the presence of sweeteners, which is concerning for me. I don't think the word deranged sounds particularly healthy. Things like alcohol as well can affect the microbiome, but also stress, lack of sleep. There's tons of influences on these microbiomes, but understanding that can be really helpful because it can allow then sort of more focused approach to how you might be eating or drinking and looking for solutions from that perspective.
Yeah, because if someone was wanting to get healthier, it's interesting that it's not just what they're eating that can make a difference. It's all these other lifestyle behaviours as well. So you touched upon engaging in hunger and fullness signals. What are some of the other factors that people could focus on if they want to just be happier and healthier in themselves?
A massive one is sleep. Now, easier said than done if sleep is a problem for you. But if you're not sleeping very well, people who will really relate to this will be people that have had babies, new mums who have had new babies, and they're up in the night feeding or are having disturbed sleep. Your appetite changes as a result of that. So if you're not getting good quality sleep, that is actually interacting the next day in a lot of hormone processes to do with your energy production and even how you process the food that you eat. So lack of sleep, number one, if you're exhausted, you might be driven for that coffee or chocolate biscuit or something. But secondly, it's due to physiology of the lack of sleep, the consequence. So for me, I might work with somebody actually predominantly initially on, how do we help you get a better night's sleep? What do we understand about your biochemistry that could be influencing that? But also what's going on with your daily routine and your lifestyle habits and all of that? Because sometimes I'm saying to people, honestly, if we can get the sleep right, I think a lot of the stuff with the food and the weight gain is going to right itself. And wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah, it's funny how it's so simple half the time of things that you need to be doing, but I think we overcomplicate it probably because we do have these mixed messages and maybe because the media is looking for a magic pill or a magic cure, but there isn't one.
I was talking to a client this morning and it was very much about they've got all of these digestive problems that have been diagnosed. And so they've been trying all these different things that are due to restriction and tons of supplements and things. And from talking to her about some of the other aspects in her life and things that are going on for her, in a way, it's missing the point to be starving the gut and to be chucking a load of antibiotics. They're herbs, but they're antibiotics into the gut when there's actually a much bigger piece to be worked on, that without working on it, it's undermining the health of the gut. I think The thing is, we're very conditioned to go for where the symptom is. Where is the symptom? Where is the problem? Let me target and focus all of my energies on this. Or, okay, I have this test result that's told me about my small intestine, so let me just focus my attention on this small intestine. But actually, that's missing so much of the massive jigsaw puzzle that is where we get to with our health.
Yeah, I suppose the approach that most people take to health is like sticking a plaster on a wound, in the sense that it doesn't really cure anything and it doesn't get to the underlying problem.
Yeah, and it's potentially damaging to how you feel emotionally. So if you've got some sort of concern about your digestion, for example, I've been there myself, and then a concern that certain foods are going to make it worse, of course, then you can't help but be aware of that 100% of the time. So it becomes overwhelming, and then you start different ways of eating that become so fearful of food that it's affecting, for me, their quality of life. And so that's the risk we take if we are so obsessed with one thing.
So then, to finish, I want to ask, if there's three things that somebody can do to start to build a healthier relationship with food, what would those three things be?
Well, I would say, number one, to start thinking about, and you don't have to do anything with it, your hunger. So I would often call this stomach hunger and mouth hunger as two different types of hunger. So stomach hunger is when your tummy is rumbling, you feel empty, you look at your watch and it's been a few hours since you've eaten. That is clear digestive hunger. Mouth hunger is where you fancy something, but if you do those other checks and balances, they're not there. Just understanding that, or checking in with yourself, can be really, really helpful. Then helping you make a decision, am I going to have something to eat or not? You don't have to do anything with it, but just starting to have that awareness is really useful. So that's probably number one. Secondly, I think it would be about always asking yourself, is there anything I can add in to this meal that's going to nourish me? So emotional eating can be a hugely positive thing if you're coming from the emotion of self-love, right? So what lovely, delicious, colourful, vibrant, tasty addition can I put into this that is going to help my immune system, my gut, my energy, my longevity, my long-term health prospects? So can I add something fresh into this? Can I put an extra bit of cucumber into this salad? Can I sprinkle some nuts onto this porridge? Or thinking about what you can add in. And then I suppose a third one would be just starting to adopt maybe more mindfulness when you're eating. So an interest in thinking about your food before you eat it, you know, anticipating it, getting excited about how you're going to present the food, even if it's a snack. You can make snacks, you can put little snacks into little bowls, or you can, you know, there's lots of inventive ways you can make even a snack look good. Connecting with food in that way, and then when you're eating it, really connecting with things like flavour, crunch. You know, we were saying at the beginning of the episode, you know, what would I take on my desert island? I immediately went to things that I knew would help me to feel engaged and excited about the food I was eating, rather than it being superfoods or, you know, that kind of thing. So starting to engage with when you're eating and the experience of eating, and enjoying the way the plate looks, taking time to dish up a nice looking plate of food, and really connecting with the flavours, the crunch, the sensation of eating, and taking your time to eat as slowly as you can and chewing as slowly as you can. That is also, you know, it's nice and positive.
I think that's a great one, actually, is just this whole sensory experience of food. It's not just grab it and go. People who eat to live and living to eat, it's actually living to eat.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Getting into the mindset of maybe Raymond Blanc or Jamie Oliver or, you know, these when you see these food lovers on the television, when you see them eat food and how the love that they get from it, I think that's a wonderful thing.
That's what we should all be aiming for.
That's the positive emotional from eating.
Nicola, would you be up to finish off with a quick fire round?
Okay, let me have a slurp of water.
Quick fire in quotes for Nicola. Porridge or pancakes?
Oh no. Oh my God, Alice. Pancakes, because you can do more with it and you can have more toppings. There's potential for savoury and sweet.
Good, I like the way you round that. Kimchi or sauerkraut?
Sauerkraut. All day long, no problem.
Beetroot or spinach?
Beetroot.
Walnuts or pistachios?
Oh no. Oh dear, this is terrible. I feel really bad for the one that I don't pick, but I still love it. So these are my top two nuts. I will go for pistachio, but can I quantify why? They're nice and colourful. They're naturally sweet. They can go in sweet and savoury things. They make a good snack. Children tend to prefer them to walnuts, which are a bit more bitter. So I think that they're possibly more versatile and they're just very, very pretty.
Salmon or sardines?
Oh no. Salmon. I probably eat it more regularly. Oh dear.
Chickpeas or lentils?
Chickpeas. I feel like, oh dear, I don't, chickpeas, I suppose.
Tahini or nut butter?
Oh no. Nut butter. I probably use it more often.
And country walk or yoga?
Country walk.
Lovely. Thank you, Nicola.
Thank you so much for asking me to chat to you. I've really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Where can people find you?
So I'm on Instagram at Nicola Moore Nutrition. My website is www.nicola-moore.com. I've got a podcast as well called Healthily. If anything has been of interest for people with this today, they might be interested in the mindful eating episode with Katie Sheen, who's really good, and the one that I did with Gemma Evans as well. But there's lots for people to dig into with that.
Perfect. Nicola, pleasure speaking to you today.
For more information about nutritional therapy, why not subscribe to Optimum Nutrition Magazine? Visit ION's website, ion.ac.uk/magazine, for details. You can also follow us on social media at ION_nutrition.